Welcome to the audio podcast of The Table at Central United Methodist Church. The podcast currently features the messages of Matt Smith and Linda Duhirsu.
With a musical introduction by Brendan Lowe, our director of music. Thanks for listening. Entered Jericho and was passing through it. A man was there named Zacchaeus. He was a chief tax collector and was rich. He was trying to see who Jesus was, but on account of the crowd, he could not because he was short in stature. So he ran ahead and climbed a sycamore tree to see him because he was going to pass that way. When Jesus came to the place, he looked up and said to him, "Zacchaeus, hurry and come down, for I must stay at your house today." So he hurried down and was happy to welcome him. And all who saw it began to grumble and said, "He has gone to the guest of one who is a sinner." Zacchaeus stood there and said to the Lord, "Look, half of my possessions, Lord, I will give to the poor. And if I have defrauded anyone of anything, I will pay back four times as much." Then Jesus said to him, "Today salvation has come to this house because he too is a son of Abraham. For the Son of Man came to seek out and to save the lost."
Won't someone wake me up? Open my eyes. Won't someone even try? Who's gonna take my hand? Show me.
Thank you for that beautiful worship, and thank you, Matt, for the beautiful introduction and the welcome, the warm welcome that you all have given me. It's just a really beautiful and blessed container to hold my heart.
Which is feeling very tender right now. So thank you for that heart-opening music. Thank you. Today I want to share a little bit with you all, beginning this sort of theme, this of migration that you all have set forth before you over the next few weeks. And so when Matt called me about it, the first thing that came to me was I really want to talk about this great migration back to the heart of God. Coming home to community and coming home to ourselves. And I love the word home. And I, in particular, in the scripture, I love how Zacchaeus, in his longing, was met by Jesus. And I love that Jesus didn't say, meet me at the office, you know, or meet me at the synagogue, or meet me at the academy, right? Jesus said, meet me at home. Can I come home? Can I visit you at home? And there's no denying that we live in really complex and frightening times. Everything that we know and read about and bombards us every day, from words about climate disaster and the suffering of migrants at our border, the suffering of those in the regions of Honduras and Guatemala and Mexico and El Salvador, the rise of fascism, resurgence of fascism and hatred in our country, mass shootings that I feel like, you know, I don't know about you. I mean, there are some weekends that we wake up to one a day, right? Crisis in our economies and in our education system and in housing and in immigration and mass incarceration and crisis in our communities of color. And we just sit with this, I don't know about y'all, but I just sit with this sense of, God, what do I do? What is mine to do? Joanna Macy, who's another beautiful eco-theologian, she talks about this time in human history as the time of the great unraveling. The great unraveling. And what I understand or what I feel when I ask God, like, what is that about? The sense that it's all sort of coming unraveled and coming apart. What I see is not ideology, and I don't see politics, and I don't see, you know, differences in parties or belief systems. Do you know what I see at the root of all of it? Is separation. This ideology of separation, right? And when did we separate, I ask myself. God, when did we separate from one another and from you? And I know all throughout human history there have been many moments of, you know, brokenness and decline and you know, resurgence. But, you know, I can point only in my own history and my context as a woman of color, as a woman of indigenous and African ancestry. You know, I can point to a time that I understand where we began to separate from one another, right? Where things like colonialism created the context where we could begin to see other people as other than ourselves, right? With genocide or enslavement, right? Where we could so other a human being that we would create of them or create within us the capacity to be brutal, to be inhuman to other human beings. And then with the introduction of capitalist systems, right, you began to see the separation from each other in as much as we began to become commodities, right? Like our time is like, what are our billable hours? And what is our productivity between 9 and 5, the sister who was speaking, you know, right? And that we began to feel like the earth was ours, not to steward, but to extract from for the benefit and the profit of a few, right? So we began to separate from each other, and we began to separate from the earth, and we began to see time as money as opposed to live within the rhythms of the earth and the rhythms of belonging to one another. And so it's an overwhelming time in history. And I ask myself in, you know, every day, God, what is mine to do, right? What is mine to do? And that's the beauty of this journey, this earthly journey that we have, is that we actually all must answer that question for ourselves. And the story that I'm going to share with you is the story of my journey, part of my journey, that I had the blessing of at one point intersecting with Matt. And it's only mine, right? The question for us and the question that I want to leave us with is, what is mine to do? And when it all begins to feel like too much, both in the global context and within our own hearts, within the brokenness of our own lives, within our own stories, within our own traumas, within our own moments of rejection, can we begin to, as opposed to run from one another and hide, come home to one another? And in so doing, then come home to what is truly the heart of God. Because Joanna Macy says that while we are in a moment in human history of the great unraveling, that great unraveling is being met by another beautiful moment, and that is the moment of the great turning. And she believes, and I believe, that is this moment right now, this pregnant moment of unraveling that leads us to turning back to each other and from this place of separation. And I know that sense of running away because you think that that's where you're going to find the answer somewhere else. I know that really, really well, right? I was born and raised in the South Bronx, New York. I am first generation. My parents migrated from Puerto Rico when they were teenagers. And so I came up, and if you know anything about, U.S., New York history or urban, some of the urban setting of the South Bronx. It was, when I was growing up in the 60s and 70s, a very dark place. You may have heard of the story of the burning of the South Bronx, burning of the Bronx, right? So that was the era that I came up with. And it was an era where public policy was such that there was a decision to shut down services like schools and fire departments and police stations and hospitals with the idea that if you shut it all down, urban renewal would come. You could start fresh, right? Not necessarily grounded in the reality of people like my parents who had no option but to stay. And many people who had no option but to stay. And so what happened during that period of time is business owners and home and tenement building owners seeing the decline, seeing this mass migration away from community, away from ourselves, would literally burn down their buildings, buildings where people were living, in the middle of the night so that they could collect the insurance money. And they would be able to leave the neighborhoods. So this is what the burning of the South Bronx was, quite literally. And this was what, as a child, there was never a conversation that wasn't interrupted by fire trucks. And there was never a conversation or a time where you didn't have this kind of smell of smoke in the air, right? This is what was happening. And yet, at the same time, while the world kind of saw that and I understood that later on, I just knew as a child that I was home, right? In a beautiful home with a mom and a dad that loved me and two sisters and my brother and a culturally rich home filled with, music and love and great food and tremendous generosity and tremendous connection to my community, right? St. Augustine says, and I love this, he says, the virtue of poverty is generosity. And that is absolutely the case. That's what I knew in my community, just the generosity and the beauty of the people. But then, at the same time, I went to school, I started high school, and what I understood is that in the eyes of the rest of the world, they did not see me as the same beautiful little girl that my parents saw me as, right? At home, I was Lalita, which was my parents' sort of love name for me. Or Negrita. Negrita is like little dark-skinned one, But where, when I was referred to as dark-skinned, it was actually with love, That's how it felt at home, but outside it felt different. Outside, the world saw me as a child of poverty, as a child of the ghetto, as at risk, right? I was at risk of being pregnant. I was at risk of dropping out of school. I was at risk of drugs. I was at risk of violence. I was the list of pathologies, the potential pathologies that could happen to me. No one ever defined me by my potential. People defined me by the things that could possibly go wrong in my life. And so I began to separate. Because that's what I was taught. I was taught that the measure of my success would not be staying home, staying in the community that I loved and that loved me, helping to build it, you know. I was taught that the measure of my success would be to separate myself from that, to leave that, to find power, to find something else outside of that, right? To find my success outside of my home, because the rest of the world would not define me as successful if I stayed in the South Bronx. And thus began my great migration away from home, right? In my late teens and early 20s, I actually found myself on Wall Street, of all places, working for David Rockefeller, of all people. Now, some generationally, some people may not know, David Rockefeller was who's the really rich guy today? So you got an image. You know what I'm talking about. So anyway, so I worked for him. And he was the chairman of Chase Manhattan Bank, and I was working there. And so, but it was interesting because for all of the success I had, right, I had a nice place. I had a nice apartment in Midtown Manhattan. You know, I could go do nice things. This gnawing feeling of separation stayed with me. And this huge desire to connect. So what did I do? Well, I began to do some volunteer work, right? Because I thought that might alleviate some of that gnawing feeling and desire for connection. I began to go back home and volunteer at my Franciscan parish that I had grown up with. I have Franciscans. I was formed in Franciscan spirituality. But I went home and began to volunteer because even though I had left the community, and I had become the quote-unquote success story, right? My community was no better for my success. That's the lie of, like, this rugged individualism, go make a name for yourself, you know, be a credit to your race, be a credit to your community, be a credit to your family, is that your individual success doesn't necessarily make your community better. And so when I went home, what I found was post the burning of the Bronx came the crack epidemic, which totally continued to decimate my community. Buildings weren't burning, but people's lives were being desecrated and burned every single day. And so I began to do some volunteer work with church, Holy Cross Church, my Franciscan parish, and Father Mike Tyson, that was really his name, my pastor. That was really his name. I was helping to organize some anti-drug prayer marches. Now, I wasn't organized or anything, but we said, well, let's go and let's go pray at some of these crack houses. And so we organized ourselves, and, you know, a couple of Sundays we went and we would go and we would pray and do prayers of exorcism out of, as a good Catholic, from these crack houses. And I thought that was, you know, okay, that felt good. I was doing something, and a few weeks later, I awoke to the news that my church, Holy Cross Church, had been torched in retaliation by drug dealers. This was in 1992, in November of 1992, so right around this time. And that radically changed me. That fire, right? Because remember, I had run from fires. And so there I was within, you know, that world saying, I feel so disconnected. I need to figure out how to connect. How do I come home? And God said, will you come home back into the fire? Will you? And so I went back that day and I found, what I found was the building, the sanctuary had been burned, and it was a Catholic church, so there was, you know, statues and such, and so, I'm watching time, Matt. And there was this big life-size statue of the Blessed Mother that had been smashed. And there were people in the sanctuary on the floor, and they were just weeping over this statue and weeping over the sanctuary. And when I walked in and saw that, there was something that stirred in my heart. And I just felt as if God said to me, I don't live here. Every day, my real temple, the bodies and the minds of my people, my children, are burnt and desecrated by crack out there. Why are you crying here? And it was a powerful moment where I began to understand where the kingdom of God really is. Where is it, right? And how church could not be a place to hide. And how sometimes we use church as a place to disconnect and to hide. And so a few weeks later, or during that period, the press was everywhere. You don't burn a church in the United States of America and not get like national press attention. Press was everywhere, and they were saying, well, you know, what are you going to do now, right? What are you going to do? And we said, we're going to march again. We're going to do this again. And a few weeks as we were planning new marches, the death threats began to come. And poor Father Mike, he was a big guy. Do you remember Father Mike? No, he was on the board. Father Mike was one of the primary targets because he lived in the friary where the priests lived. And when that happened, you know, I was in my early 20s, I was sure that he would say, you know, we need to stop, we need to cancel this, right? So this is for those of you who work with young people and feel like what you do and say doesn't matter, because it does. Because when I went to Father Mike and I said, Father, what are we going to do? Fully expecting him to cancel, he said, oh, I went to the 43rd precinct and they lent me a bulletproof vest. And poor Father Mike, who was already a big guy, had this like big bulletproof vest. But in that moment, you know, here was this person, a white man, you know, the privilege of clergy, could have hidden, could have gone wherever, you know, but was willing to stand and be the target in front of this community. And so on a beautiful November day, we marched again. We marched again. And everyone said, no one is going to come because there were threats that the crowd would be shot into. And I walked down the street that day to over 1,000 people from my community. And do you know what was beautiful? Was that God taught me about power there. Remember that I left home. I did this great migration away from home because I was looking for what this elusive thing of power, right? And so in that sea of people, God said, you're looking for power? Look. And David Rockefeller, God bless his soul, was not there. But my papa was there. My papa came to New York when he was 18. He was homeless. My dad was orphaned at 3. He had a third grade education. He slept on subways, and my father also suffered from addiction. While he was, in my childhood, a manager of the public housing projects. You met my dad. Not a manager, a maintenance man within the public housing projects. So daddy's job, when I would go to school every single day, I would go down the stairs and I would see papa, and papa would be cleaning the walls of urine because men would relieve themselves in the stairwells. That was papa's job. And I would go down the stairs, and in my tradition, we ask for a blessing when we see our elders, and so I'd say, bendición, papi. And he'd say, que Dios y la Virgen te acompañe, mija. May God and his mother walk with you today, my child. And I'd go off to school. That was Papa. Papa was there. The man who washed urine off of elevator walls was there. The immigrant mother pushed with, you know, baby stroller pushing her children. The drug dealer. The kids. the pregnant teen, all of the people that the world, through this view of separation, had told me was powerless, were the ones that my heart pointed to that day and said, here, here is where you find your power. Here is where you find home. And that experience radically, radically changed me. And God said, will you meet me at home? And there are two stories in Scripture similar to this one. If I tell the other one, I'm not a biblical scholar, people. I'm not ordained. I'm just letting y'all know. So sometimes I tell stories and you're like, no, that's not the story. Go with me. There was a rich young man who was also looking after, looking for Jesus, looking, right? And he went and he found him, just like Zacchaeus, I can pronounce his name. And he said, Jesus, what do I need to do? Like, I do all this good stuff, right? I give to the poor, I'm a good guy. What do I need to do to enter your kingdom? And Jesus looked at him and said, give up everything you have. Give up everything you have and come and follow me. And that story is a little ends a little differently than this one, because this one, Zacchaeus gives up half of his goods and agrees to, you know, repay four times over anything he's cheated, and Jesus is in his house. This one ends a little differently. This one just says he walked away sad because he had so much. So you really never know. Did he go home? Did Jesus get to go back to his home with him? So what are the, and so I went back home, and that's a whole other talk about this season in my life that Matt talked about, the almost two decades of my life from the time I was about maybe 25, that I founded Youth Ministries for Peace and Justice back home in my community. I knew that I wanted a place where, like here, church was more than just about getting us into heaven. When there was literally hell breaking loose around me and in my community, right? It had to be more than that. And we had to not just feel like we had to wait for some savior, be it in the form of a politician or elected official or some person of wealth that was going to swoop down and save us, but that somehow God, in the desire of us in the fullness of our dignity, wanted us to figure out how we might save ourselves. Self-determination. And so I came home, and I spent 20 years in the field of environmental justice and education reform and immigration reform and police reform and racial justice and all of those things, because that was what was happening at home. And while I could, from afar on Wall Street, you know, give some nice donations or say some good prayers when I went to church, what God was saying was, Lexi, will you meet me at home? Will you meet me at home? And so it's been a long journey from that time, that season in my life. And there's many stories I can tell, but I want to share with you just four lessons that I learned during that time about going home. And I'll leave you with those. One, as I shared earlier, is that beneath the ideology, beneath the politics, beneath all of the words about this moment in human history is fundamentally separation. This sense that we no longer belong to one another. Like, look at, like, hold that, if nothing else, in your heart. Look at me, this woman that you may never see again, right? And remember that I belong to you. My people belong to you, just as your people belong to me. And that is the great gift that we are given, in our humanity that we have lost. There's a term, an African term, Ubuntu. Some of you may be familiar with it. Essentially, it means a person is a person because of other persons. I am because you are, and because you are, I am. I am because we are, and because we are, then I am. Right? It is that great circle. We know it as the great web of life. You know, in all of our faith traditions, in all of the wisdom traditions, we can find that beautiful, deep nugget of understanding that we belong to one another. So, if we belong to one another, if we believe that fundamentally, that our issue is separation from one another, then the second lesson is that when we come home, home is about connection to one another. I came up, many of us came up, in a Christianity that sadly was so self-indulgent, right? And even outside of Christianity, you know, all sorts of movements, whether they're mind, and I'm not trying to be disparaging of any movement, but I am critical of any faith tradition that is simply about escapism and about using church or using mindfulness or using anything to connect us so to God that we no longer feel that we need to connect to one another. That is not home. That is not God. I didn't go to seminary, I'm not a theologian, but I know that. I know that. And I pray that we know that and that we have the courage and the heart to seek after a faith that says, strengthened by my connection to God, I will come home to God in you and in you and in my children and in my partner and in the people in my community and the people around me. The third thing about coming home and being connected is then we need to connect in right relationship, right? In authentic relationship. And so for me, what that means is that we must be willing to not simply be charitable. We love our charity as a church, let's be real. Okay? It's easier. It's easier. Dorothy Day used to say, you know, it's like if you are on a street and someone gets hit by a truck. Our Christian inclination, our human inclination, is to go and like tend to that person and provide the triage, right? But what if you get up and another person is being hit by a truck? And another person is hit by a truck? And another person is hit by a truck. If at some point you don't send somebody out to figure out where these trucks are coming from, then all the triage in the world is not going to help, right? And that is the danger of charity alone. Charity is important, but we must meet charity with the work of justice. Ooh, that's scary. The work of justice. What is mine to do, God? What do I do? I can't answer that for you. But I know that God has for each and every one of us within our own sphere, within the tiny little community that not tiny, 65,000 people in less than a square mile, 50% of which lived under the poverty level. That was my community. But that was where God wanted me. You know, didn't send me somewhere else. It was there. And so within our own sphere, we must find and understand that justice is the work that we must do. It is the work of the church. Martin Luther King said it this way. He said, if the church does not recapture its prophetic zeal, it will become no more than an irrelevant social club without any moral or spiritual authority. If the church does not actively engage in the work of racial justice, economic justice, social justice, it will cause people to say, as people say today, that it has atrophied its will. Think about what it feels like out there to walk, trying to walk as a Christian in these times, right? It's a very difficult thing. I'm embarrassed, honestly. I'm embarrassed by the fact that we are so quick to want to organize a mission trip, but don't want to meet those very suffering people at our border. God says, you don't have to go out there and do that, build that school. I'm going to bring them to you. Ooh, wait a minute. You know? So this is what is ours to do, is to connect, but connect in right relationship. And then finally, to come home. To come home. And I'm going to say, so I'll share with you, I'm going to close. I'm going to share with you a dream my mama had. I prayed for my mama earlier. And pray for my mama. She's 80 now, and she's got some early dementia. My papa passed away 5 years ago. So it's been a tough journey for her. My mommy is a woman of deep and profound faith, and I believe deep prophetic faith. And right around the turn of the century, do you remember how everybody was worried about, like, oh, there's going to be a Y2K virus? Or, you know, people were going to mountaintops because they thought the end, that was it. God was finally coming because it was God's job to fix things. Things were messed up, if we only knew, right? Like now, 19 years later, things were messed up, and, you know, God was going to fix things. So in Mama's dream, Mama was and she shared this dream with me many years ago, and I share it all the time. She was in a sanctuary like this, and she was by herself. And she was praying. And she says, as she was praying outside, there was a crowd of people. And the people were crying out, Lord, when are you coming? Lord, when are you coming? And Mama said, God didn't answer. And so she said, the people kept crying out, when are you coming, Lord? When are you coming? Because they were waiting for God to come down and like land and fix everything. And God wouldn't answer. And the people kept crying out. And she said, finally, do you know what God said? What, Mama? God said, when are you coming? When are you coming? And that's the question that I leave planted in our hearts today. Me too, because the journey home is a continuous one. It's not just to our physical home, right? The journey to the heart of God and to justice, to understanding what is ours to do, what is within my sphere of influence, God. And God is always lovingly, patiently waiting for us at home, asking, when are you coming? Amen.